All right, we're ready to get started now. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the fifth edition of Under the Weather, Climate Change, Research, and Justice, featuring Holly Dressel. This monthly lecture series is brought to you by CKUT, the McGill Sustainability Projects Fund, and Climate Justice Montreal. And each lecture is broadcasted live on CKUT's airwaves on 90.3 FM or online at ckut.ca, hence all the fancy equipment that you see here. For more information on the project, you can visit undertheweather.ckut.ca, and I'll also post the URL to the podcast on that page. And to introduce tonight's speaker, we have Melissa Fundira. Melissa is a student in the McGill School of Environment, and she's also currently a student of Holly's. She's also a journalist for the MSc and a programmer for Equilibrium, CKUT's environmental radio show. Please welcome Melissa Fundira.
Thanks, Irene. So in past Under the Weather talks, speakers have been introduced by Climate Change Montreal activists and very accomplished journalists. And Irene basically chose me because I'm Holly's biggest groupie. And the first time I ever met Holly, she was a guest lecturer for a course on an environmental impact assessment, which was very difficult to get excited about. But the first day she kind of walked in class and started drawing a dragon with three heads on the board. And she says something to the effect of, "The heart and the throat of the dragon is our capitalist system. And even if our weapons are weaker than the dragon, we can use our hope to attack its weak points." And that was the day that I became Holly's groupie, basically. And I'm certainly not the only one. She has a very special way of reigniting hope in us students who it's very easy to become discouraged when we learn about the realities of climate change. And she also has a very unique way of reminding us why we're studying what we're studying. So we're very grateful to her for that. Holly's list of credentials is very, very long, so I'm only going to mention a couple of things. She is an accomplished and best-selling author. Many have been co-authored with celebrated environmentalist David Suzuki, such as From Naked Ape to Super Species and Good News for a Change. She has also written a book of her own called Who Killed the Queen, which is an extensive overview of the history and status of the Canadian healthcare system. She's also a researcher and writer for TV and radio and has contributed to award-winning programming such as The Nature of Things and the feature-length documentary H2 Oil. And in more recent years, Holly has added to her list adjunct professor at the McGill School of Environment. Today's talk is about our connection to the soil and how we can eat meat for the good of the planet. And this is a topic not too far from Holly's own experiences, having lived on a farm since her late 20s. She's also most recently been very involved in Justice Alimentaire pour Montréal, or Food Justice Montreal, and has brought a lot of her expertise in the effort to bridge the gap between food security and food justice here in Montreal. So without further ado, please help me welcome Holly Dressel.
Thank you. That was a terrific, I don't know, I hope I can live up to the introduction. Okay, so one of the things that we thought about calling this was meat equals soil, how diet affects sustainability. And what this has to do with global warming, of course, has to do with how our diet affects climate change, obviously, and how biodiversity affects climate change. So I'd start with just a few questions. How many people here eat, like, just regular meat, regular old supermarket or, in you know, supermarket meat regularly? Okay. How many eat are vegan or vegetarian? And how many eat only meat that is, you know, organic or like that? Okay. So we've got a really nice mix. It's almost equal. That's great. But I would like to start, especially for people who are maybe vegetarian or vegan. Okay, so I was with Elizabeth May in the Gulf Islands off BC when she announced to a crowd of kind of sandal-wearing macrame old hippies that they were reopening the local slaughterhouse. And this was greeted with joy and screams of delight by people who I'm sure had not had any cow pass their lips in decades. And I'm wondering if you know why this would be true, why they were excited about it. The reason is that all over Canada, we have been closing down our local small slaughterhouses, which means that small farmers that are raising animals sustainably, you know, 5 or 6 or 10 pigs and a few cows and so forth, would have to truck them hundreds and hundreds of kilometers to get them slaughtered legally. And so they don't. In other words, the whole system is increasingly set up only for agribusiness, for gigantic businesses, and is increasingly less accessible to organic and small farmers. And by reopening the local slaughterhouse, she was making the whole small farm organic food business more viable, and that's why everybody was so excited about it. I don't know how many of you drive around. You can actually get prosecuted, by the way, in Quebec for selling your own meat, or, you know, to your own family. And these are big problems. There's a great book out by a famous organic farmer named Joel Salatin. I don't know if anybody ever heard of him. My favorite book by Joel is called Everything I Want to Do is Illegal. And what he means, basically, is that the food system has been captured by gigantic corporations, and anything that is of a local type and accessible. For instance, if I wanted to raise a few cows, I would have to dig for them their own private well. I'm not allowed to have them drink out of the little pond that's on my property. That would cost $6,000, $7,000 alone. And not only that, you know, digs into the aquifer in a way that the standing water up above wouldn't do. There are a lot of things out there. At one point, the Quebec government made it illegal to raise chickens outdoors. And would actually, right, somebody's nodding, and would actually find flocks, you know, drive around looking for flocks and then kill them all if you had your flocks, you know, able to see the light of day. This was during the avian flu epidemic when they were blaming avian flu on wild birds and little flocks when, of course, it was coming out of gigantic CAFOs. How many people know what a CAFO is? Confined animal feeding operation. So it's these gigantic, huge things like hog farms, where you lock the animals up in what amounts to a concentration camp, and you keep them there under very, very unnatural circumstances, like big poultry farms, you know, nail them to the perch if necessary, which they do, feed them their own dead bodies. Nobody wants to know what they feed chicken, or you will not be able to eat it again. And, you know, this kind of laws were made for these organizations. So these organizations also need really, really strict, as you can imagine, cleanliness guidelines and, you know, slaughtering. Everything has to be drenched in bleach and, you know, or of course it's poisonous. This is not true of a small operation. So the small operation has to come up to these gigantic industrial levels if they want to kill anything, if they want to sell milk. And it's completely insane. And it is not done anywhere but North America. It's not done in Europe. Europe does not require small farmers to do this kind of thing at all. And the interesting thing is that they have, are you ready for this, not half the food board poisonings that we do. They have 15 times less food poisoning than we do. And if you've ever been to Europe, you know what it's like. You go to the market, and there's, you know, a dead rabbit hanging there in the sun, and there's a cheese with mold all over it, and right? No, this is not the way that human beings get food poisoning. They get food poisoning from Smithfield and from Maple Leaf, where there's, you know, constant contamination that goes through a huge facility and reaches millions of people. And I once spoke not that long ago to all the food inspection agents in Canada, all the federal food inspection agents at a huge conference, and they know this. What they want is a more localized food system. They know that this is a terrible idea. They want to get rid of great, big, centralized operations, but they don't have the power to do it. They're the ones that get sent in when the listeria or the salmonella are detected, and they have to clean up the mess, and everybody gets mad at them and says, why didn't you inspect it? Well, because all the laws have been taken away, so it's supposed to be voluntary inspection from within the operation, and even if you come in as a federal inspector and you find horrible situations, you are not allowed to close down the facility. The facility itself has to decide to. So obviously you need deaths before that will happen. So they want more of a local food system already, even those guys. So the another thing I wanted to ask is, you know, like I, those of you who eat just vegetables, I live in blueberry country, and I know a lot of blueberry farmers who just get apoplectic because they come into town. They work really hard on organic blueberries, and they come in here and they see the berries that they grew. They're 50 kilometers away or less, being sold for a 600% markup, 600 times more than they get. For taking all the risks, for growing it, for paying the taxes, for owning the land, blah, 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 everything. And all the middlemen did was give it a short ride in a truck and put it in a supermarket. And this is typical of the food system again. And one of the things that they are trying to do is get Quebec to stand by its so-called policy of local food. They claim they favorize local food, but they don't. It's all voluntary. So if a supermarket wants to put some signs on the cheese and say this is local cheese because they think they'll make more money, they can do that. But they don't have to do that. And they don't have to tell us that those potatoes are from here and these potatoes were trucked in from California or something. They don't have to do that. I mean, if you're really careful, sometimes you can tell, but often you can't. So these are more of the kind of thing that we're up against. But I want to get into cows and livestock out there in the world because there is an idea about them causing a lot of trouble. And increasingly they are. Until recently, dairy was not a real problem. People did not focus on dairy cows as a tremendous contributor to global warming and general pollution because they were out there eating grass, making milk. And just about 5 or 6 years ago, the Quebec government and many other governments upped the milk quota, the quota that farmers have to reach in order to retain their license to sell milk, to the extent that a farmer has to have 80 to 100 milking cows just to keep his quota. Now, one farmer can't take 80 or 100 cows out every morning and back in at night to the pasture. He just physically can't do it. So what they've started to do is build these gigantic barns. If you go out in the country, you'll see them. They have no sides. They're open at the side to get a little bit of air in there. And they lock the dairy cows up for their entire lives. They are chained up. They do not walk. They do not run. They do not take care of their babies. An average dairy cow we used to milk about 12 years. These guys are culled at 4 because they are so sick. You can imagine if you were chained up. And not only that, they aren't fed what they were evolved to eat, which is grass. They are fed hay, but they're also fed this slurry of grains and Monsanto-type chemicals to keep them going. And that's what they make the milk out of. And they can only do it for 4 years before they keel over. So that is what has happened to dairy all over Quebec very, very recently. And it has to do, again, with the industrialization of the food supply. And it greatly, obviously, adds to global warming because these animals are not doing what they evolved to do, and I'm about to talk about that. By the way, how many of you, this also is going to lead to sprawl, because as the animals are taken off the land, we have a law in Quebec. How many people know about the Green Law in Quebec? Oh, gee, how do I get this off? There we go. We have one of the most progressive farm laws in the world. And here's Montreal, and here's the river going by, and here's the New York border, the Ontario border, the Beauce is up here. This whole area of farmland, it's the only dairy-producing, really decent cropland in Quebec, really, because north of here, you know, it's the Canadian Shield. So the Parti Québécois put it under, froze it in the 70s because they had this quaint idea that if you're going to have a country, you ought to have some control over your food supply. Imagine that. They thought that it should be the Québécois raising their own food, and they wanted to make sure that people couldn't come in from the outside and seize it away from them, which was called food security in the old days. And we still have it. So to this day, this area is frozen for agricultural use. You can't even build a barn on a farm. On any area that's considered productive, you're not allowed to. So, and much less, you know, chop. You're not allowed to subdivide your farm or anything like that. So instead of having to fight tooth and claw to save, you know, some beautiful area like this, like say this was Toronto, we'd be fighting to save it
for agricultural use. Here it's the opposite. Here the developers have to fight and go before the CPTAQ, which is the Commission pour la Protection du Terrain Agricole du Québec, and they are very unlikely to say yes to anything. So we have that, and we could expand on it, and it's a really cool thing, but it's not working as well as we might want. Now, I'm afraid that if we continue to take dairy and other animals off the land, then people will say, well, that land is no longer in agricultural production, therefore we ought to be able to develop it, right? You see what I mean? So then you have that vision of you know, you sometimes get that vision with the loofah movement or something, you know, where we'll have, you know, high rises growing our vegetables, hydroponic, and in Holland already, apparently they have high rises full of industrial hogs. And that is going to be how we're going to get our food in the future. And that's what I want to talk about today. I have a student who just the other day in class said something very concise. He said, meat is not the problem when it comes to pollution and climate change. Industrial meat is the problem. Because the natural habits of animals are not what's contributing to global warming. In other words, you know, yeah, cows poop and they fart methane and they eat all that grain that people could eat. Well, actually, they don't. Actually, what is so cool about them is that they can eat grass, which nothing else hardly can eat, and turn it into protein and milk and everything you could want. We are forcing them to eat grain. We are making them eat grain. We are making them sick. They die at 4 instead of 12. A third there be like you guys dying at, you know, 25 instead of 80 or 90, right? Because of a horrible diet. And we say, oh, aren't they terrible? They're eating all the grain that could go to humans. And they're not doing what they were evolved to do, which was to live on the land and work with the soil. Now, I want to imagine what would happen if we all became vegans and vegetarians, which I sometimes get the feeling in the environmental movement that's what, you know, people want, you know, or think would be good. And it scares me to death. Because, I mean, what I envision if we do that is, you know, field after field of soybeans or brown rice and vegetables, fertilized by what? I mean, we're talking about, you know, an extreme future here where there's 12 billion of us on the planet. We've all had to become vegetarians because there's not enough protein otherwise and so forth. But if we did that, how does the soil keep producing the vegetables? What fertilizes it? Soil doesn't just keep producing every year. You've got to put stuff back in, right? And we've been putting chemicals in. We've been putting fossil fuels, fossilized carbon, and fossilized oil-derived chemical fertilizers or manure from quadrupeds like cows. And people say, well, we'll have to use our own. So we'll have these big, we'll have these acres and acres of vegetables that will be fertilized by our own poop. Coming out of the cities, it's coming out anyway, we might as well do something useful with it. So that'll be the world, you know, the big circle will be our poop, we'll eat the vegetables will grow on our poop, and so on. And that would work maybe if you don't know a couple things about our poop. First of all, industrial sludge coming out of cities is filled with pathogens, heavy metals, because of the sewage system that drains things like cars leaking and gas stations and small industries, right? Hospitals, tons of pharmaceuticals, and in general is not safe to put on the land, although it is legal. All over Canada, it was made legal by a stroke of the pen in, I think, 1989 or something, because they figured out they couldn't dump it in the ocean anymore because it was killing all the fish. So they said, oh, well, then let's just put it on our food crops. But in fact, it is extremely unsafe because of the heavy metals. It will eventually destroy the ability of the soil to survive at all. So unless we work out a sewage system in which the poop and the pee is completely separated from anything else, anything that isn't, you know, like the soap or anything coming out of your washing machine, then we can't do that. But there's another problem. Even if we manage to do that, human beings are not cows. We do not have four stomachs. Our poop is extremely, in fact, almost identically like the poop of pigs. Another omnivore. Pigs, even if they're on a vegetarian diet, have way too much phosphorus and nitrates in their manure to use continuously, which is why the big industrial hog farms all around the southern part of Quebec have polluted all the waterways around there, why we have five dead rivers in Quebec, why we get blue green algae blooms, blue-green algae blooms in the summer that are very dangerous. It's because of all the hog poop, which is cannot be absorbed by the soil and the environment. It can up to a point if you don't use very much of it, but if you use a lot of it, it destroys everything. And it's not really a healthy thing for the soil. So we've got that problem. Now, so I'm not so sure it's a good deed in that sense to assume that this would be the world, right? Because we've got this minimal world with just humans, no farm animals, no wild animals, because, you know, if we're all madly eating vegetables, we need every bit of land we can get, everything marginal that formerly was wetlands or swamps or, you know, wildlife is going to be turned into some method of growing food for us, right? Now, I think there's a different way to do it. And I'm also afraid that we need to do it really soon because we're also increasing the amount of meat we eat. We are eating 20%, we've eaten 20% more meat now than we did in 1961, but 10% more than we did in 1991, which is really per capita in Canada. So despite the fact that quite a few of us have become vegetarian or vegan or very careful about what they eat, the meat consumption is still going crazy. And the meat consumption in itself is a worry in terms not just of the environment, but of our own health, right? So I'm worried that we've set this whole thing up to eat something on a regular basis that used to be a treat, a rare treat, and that's greatest use on the planet was to keep the ecosystem going, the carbon cycle, and to produce manure and milk and hides, but not necessarily a big chunk of meat to eat every meal. Now, the future that I see looks a lot more like an idealized past with a lot of small holdings. Small holdings are small farms with mixed production. So animals and plants, grains, some fruit, chickens scratching around in the yard, and a small local family. Now, you're going to say, oh, my God, that's not going to work out because we tried that and it doesn't work anymore, right? But as a matter of fact, we're going to discuss why it does because we're right at the fork of these two visions. These two kinds of farms are in existence right now. The absolute horror of the monocultured farm with chemicals and cruelty and everything you can imagine, and these little CSA organic local farms that I'm sure many of you are aware of or maybe plugged into are also on the rise. 20% per year for the past 15 years organics has been growing all over Canada, and so we've got both right now. The question is, which one do we think is going to, you know, deal with our future best? So let's just imagine. I think we're going to imagine if we look at this from a biological point of view, what do we need for food? We need three things. Sunlight, right, for photosynthesis. Water and soil. Question is, what is soil? And that is the biggest question of all. Very few of us know what it is. Soil is it a matrix? Is it just, you know, dirt and, you know, chunks of rock and so forth like that? Or is there more to it? Is it alive, for instance? Well, as a matter of fact, soil is a living ecosystem. The average teaspoon of soil contains several million living beings, viruses, bacteria, but also little tiny insects, all kinds of biota, all kinds of fungi, lichen, and so on. And recently, people have been looking into them very much, and they're finding there's a whole world down there. It's like Horton Hears a Who. Seriously, I mean, some of these little things like tardigrades look just like stuffed teddy bears. And they're called water bears, in fact. Does anybody ever see them? And there's these little blue things that do little backflips. We don't know why. Maybe they enjoy it. Some of these creatures actually groom each other. They have been observed grooming each other. They don't just, you know, eat each other and run around like that. So, there's whole kinds of creatures that graze, like on the lichen forest, and other creatures that predate on the things that are grazing and so forth. So there's this whole world going on. And what that world does, of course, is the carbon cycle. And does everybody know what the carbon cycle is? Yeah, it's like ashes to ashes, dust to dust, right? The carbon cycle, there's the births, and there's the deaths. And they both feed each other, and they just keep going around. Everything that is alive because it either eats or came out of something that was dead. Everything that is alive or born eventually will die. Right? That is a definition of life. That is the definition of the carbon cycle. So I like to say that if anything, any kind of system, it's a circle, any kind of system you're looking at on this planet, if it's not a circle, it's not going to work out. It's what the planet's made out of, circles. I saw a PBS documentary the other night on the dome of the cathedral in Florence, and for 500 years, nobody's been able to figure out how they built it because it's so gigantic. Did anybody else see that? And it's got all these, it looks like some kind of octagon or, you know, sides like, there was shapes like this, right? But when they took them apart, what they discovered was holding it together is that it's one huge spiral. That's why it doesn't fall apart. That's why it works. It's a circle. I thought that was kind of cool. So these life forms in the soil, if you sever your land from the ecosystem processes, and that is what industrial farming does. It does several things. By using fossil fuel-based agricultural chemicals of any kind, whether they're pesticides or fertilizers, kills them. It's literally pouring poison on the little who's as they're bounding around in there. And then they're dead. And when they're dead, all you have left is the sand and the minerals, and it quickly compacts until it's just as hard as this floor, and you can't even get water in it. You can't get a hole in it. One of the big problems with agriculture in certain parts of the world is just drilling holes in the hard pan to try to, you know, get something in there again so that you can have soil, and is stuffing it full of manure and hoping that you can restore it. There are people who make their living doing nothing but that. In other words, it's a short-term thing using industrial chemicals. So you can't do that. And if you use, I suspect, the wrong kind of poop, the too much pig poop and too much human poop, you're also going to have problems with growing your vegetables or your other plants. Now, what cows do is they poop and they pee on the ground, but they also tear it up. And how many people believe in the principles of evolution here? I assume most of you. Right, we're not in Indiana. Yay. Okay, so in evolution, the plants don't evolve first and then the animals show up, right? Everybody co-evolves more or less at the same time. So, you know, like the hummingbird gets a longer and longer beak as the flower gets a deeper and deeper, right? Or maybe a more, you know, everything complements each other, it has to live off each other. So the same thing is happening with pasture land. And what they've found is, unfortunately, cows and many of our domestic animals are enough like the quadrupeds that lived here before we got agriculture here. In other words, the buffalo and the antelope and the deer and so forth. And they live very similarly in herds, and they bunch up in herds when they're scared, and they poop and pee all over the place because they're scared of the wolves or the coyotes or whatever's at them, and then they run over in another little bunch and do that again. And while they're there, they tear up the ground. And when they do that, the ground is able to fertilize various seeds. Seeds are actually evolved to not germinate unless this happens to them. So you've got the animals out there in the pasture making it germinate, making a thicker and more luxuriant soil if you are pasturing them properly. That's the question. And there's more and more people out there that are learning how to do this or relearning how to do this, like Joel Saladin, where you figure out the exact number of cows or that you're going to be able to put on so much acreage of a certain type that you will get the maximum amount of grass for the cow's health and well-being. And what people have found when they go measure these pastures is that they are carbon sinks. So, you know, despite the methane and the poop and all that, it's the cow is not contributing to global warming when raised the way it should be in a healthy manner, right? And allowed to do what it does, not just, you know, born for a couple of years and then slaughtered, you know, kept inside and then slaughtered, but actually out in the ecosystem doing what it evolved to do. Which, of course, also means that we would have fewer of them available to eat every day. How many people think that would be a bad idea? I mean, you know, there's an obesity epidemic. There's all kinds of heart disease. There's clearly human beings cannot handle having, you know, birthday present dinner every day of their lives. And when I was young, meat was something literally you ate on Sunday. You ate a big, the only time you saw a portion of meat was on Sunday. And in other countries, this is not that unusual either. And you would flavor food with meat, but you would not eat chunks of meat. You just simply, it was too expensive. And so the meat was the treat that it should be in our diet. And it also meant that there was enough land that you did not have to raise the meat in crowded conditions that meant that it does not do what it's supposed to do on the land. That is to keep the soil built. So one of the big problems that we have in this country is that changing from this, because really this is how everyone farmed in the 30s and 40s, mixed holdings. It was specifically changed by the government, by laws, by legislation, by things like, you know, tax breaks or other methods. And the farmers were always made to feel it was their fault. You know, they weren't being efficient if they didn't get bigger and they weren't doing it right. And they deserved to lose their farm if they tried to hold on to the old methods. But what actually was happening, those of you who have read Silent Spring by Rachel Carson, anybody? It's a book that was the first book to attack the industrialization of agriculture. And she makes it clear that what was decided was that food was seen as something you produce as cheaply as possible for the rising labor force that's going to live in the city. And while they did this, there was no consideration whatsoever given to the ongoing viability of the family farm, to the depopulation of the rural areas. In fact, they wanted to depopulate them, or to the health of the land. No consideration at all. The land was just a given, literally. If you look at these, it's there. There's nothing we can do wrong to it. We can treat it any way we want. The main thing is to get more out of it, right? By any means, hook or crook, chemicals, machines, we don't care. Suck more out of it. This year, next year, the year after. Get bigger. Now, this was because there was a belief that land was an economic commodity. And through technological progress and factory production and business acumen, it could be made to function exactly like a factory. Just getting better and better and better and more efficient all the time. Of course, even a factory has a limit to that. It was never seen as what it actually is. It was seen as a mechanical system, and it's a biological system. We shouldn't be surprised that it's not working out. It's only been, hasn't even been a full generation since we had this revolution, and it is not working out, as I'm sure you know. There are vast amounts of contaminated land and water problems and God knows what else, as well as people with obviously the wrong diet. And yet nobody's talking enough, I think, about this. Well, I shouldn't say nobody, because actually they are. I was going to say that if we want to fight for food security and food parity and justice and good food in general, we need to understand the entire agricultural system and not just withdraw from it. You know, it's easy to say, oh, it's so icky, I'm not going to eat any of that. That doesn't really get to it, does it? And it doesn't really help the cows or the pigs. You have to understand what you're doing. You can boycott it if you understand what it is, and the boycott is going to be effective. If the boycott is not being effective, then you have to figure out what else you need to change in it. And it has to do a lot with the whole attitude towards what food is and what animals are. Now, I think you would find it hopefully heartening that it's not just kinder and more sustainable and more just and equitable and nutritious and beautiful and all that. It's actually more economically efficient to go back to those small holdings I was describing that sounded so utopian and kind of, you know, fluffy, right? And that has been proven. And those of you who have been my students in the past know I am just about to talk about the IASTD. But before I get to that, I am going to say that the reason that we thought that this big, huge industrial system was going to work out is quite understandable. I mean, right now, if you go on StatsCan tonight and you look up farm production, you will see it say something like, since 1941, Canada is producing 175% more food on roughly the same amount of agricultural land. In other words, since we went industrial. And you'll go, well, oh, God, obviously we have to keep doing this. I mean, we can't suddenly go down to two-thirds less food. And I'm here to explain to you that the reason these stats look like this is that there has been a long period of basically cooking the books. It looks this way if you never subtract. This is one of the things that human beings like to do a lot with technology. We like to talk about all the positive things it's going to bring. We never talk about the negative things it's going to bring, right? We're getting a little better than that, but not much. And particularly the industries that are pushing it never talk about that. Now, if extreme industrial fertilizers and pesticides, you appear to get, you will get tons and tons of data showing year one we used, you know, before we used it, this is so much yield per acre. Year we used it, we got twice as much yield or whatever, a third again as much, whatever. What they didn't do was subtract the extra costs the farmer had to pay for the inputs, for starts. So he has to get that money from somewhere. He has to either put more land into production or he has to work off farm or he has to go into debt, more like, right? They don't mention that it costs more money to get that bigger lake. B, they don't subtract the loss of yield that killing all the soil biota will cause over time. They don't subtract the cost of polluted waterways everywhere, of the fishermen downstream who no longer can make a living. None of that is subtracted, and it's really big, let me tell you. And, of course, if you don't subtract the global climate effects of all that dependence on machinery and transport to faraway markets, so that this is all the non-subtracting you're doing. In 2001, in Canada alone, the combined effects of soil erosion, acidification, compaction, salinization cost $1.5 billion through reduced yields. This is just the damages directly caused by the inputs. It's not the cost of the inputs, right? So when they say the yields are up, they are not cost counting. They're lying, in fact, and in many cases they are not mentioning. For instance, they literally would measure a field that was both barley and spinach, and then they plant it the next year just to corn and say we got more grain. I mean, there is a lot of cooking of the books done in the Green Revolution, and many people have found it. So now I'm going to get, and finally, this is the best part of all. You know how I told you measure the year, the first year you put it in. You go, oh, my God, we got a huge seed. Let's go out and get some more. If you measure over 5 years, it has now been proven, a mere 5 years, not 10, not 20, the yield goes down to either what you had with the organic method or less. So it is a one-year thing. It's like giving somebody a shot of heroin, and they leap out of bed and they dance around, and then they fall down dead later anyway, right? It's a little bit like that. It's drugs. So I am now going to talk about the IAASTD, which maybe, I don't know if this will go this far. Nope. It's okay. It stands for the International Assessment of Agriculture. Wait a minute. I can never remember. Of Agriculture Knowledge, Science, and Technology for Development. And what it is, how many people know what the IPPC is? Right. That was when we weren't sure about global warming, and the UN said, oh, my God, let's get a bunch of really good climate scientists together, hundreds, and have them research and fill several airplane hangars full of data and figure out if global warming exists and if we're causing it, and that's exactly what they did. Well, the IASTD is exactly the same thing for farming, because what was happening is there were people like Vandana Shiva and a famous agronomist named Miguel Altieri, and virtually all, I mean, hundreds if not thousands of peasant farmers, organizations, and traditional people all saying, this is bullshit, this stuff doesn't work, you know, just saying what I just told you about the lack of real yields and the real costs. And so the UN wasn't quite sure what we had to do in the future. Meanwhile, I don't know if you remember this, just a few years ago, there was all this talk about a new green revolution. Does anybody remember the new green revolution? You're a little young, but I think some people do. It was about 6 or 7 years ago, and the biotech industry was just delirious that the IASTD had come about, because what they were hoping was that they would get the next generation of biotech, Terminator technology, you know, even fancier weirdness, synthetic biology, more chemicals, you know, generally everything we've got now that caused the problems on steroids. And they put money into the ISTD. And what the rest of us, including the peasant farmers, were very, very nervous, because who supported the ISTD was the World Bank, all the usual suspects, all, you know, the big outfits that are actually doing very well under the status quo. And the biotech industry put money into it. And so they were very excited about what would happen when all these scientists revealed what was happening. In 2008, the report came out. They had an in-person gigantic UN meeting with all the stakeholders, and they did exactly the opposite of what everyone expected. They said, you know what? The only way to the future are small holdings. Multifunctionality, they called it. That means mixed farming with animals and plants on holdings less than 2 hectares. It's about 6 acres. Anything over that loses efficiency. This is what the research has shown of hundreds and hundreds of agronomists all over the world looking to see what works for our future. The amount of resiliency in these small mixed farms is amazing. It is resilient from climate change. For instance, you know, a monsoon goes through, or an unexpected freeze or whatever. These little farms do thousands of times better than the monocultures, and they don't have the inputs, and on, and it went. And then they even said, as for biotech, because this is a heavily industrialized system, because it depends on expensive patents, because we are not really sure that it's safe, and it certainly can contaminate other forms of seed so that they can't be grown anymore, we don't see that there's a future for it in a sustainable agricultural food system. At which point the biotech industry got up and walked out in a huge tantrum. And everyone in the world has signed on to the ISTD report, all the countries in the world, except for the US, Canada, and Australia. We are the only countries in the world that have not signed on, which might be why you've never heard of it. You've never heard of it, right? But it is big news, and it is bearing fruit, because already, this came out in 2008, most of the UN departments that have anything to do with food and agricultural organization, the CBD, the Convention on Biological Diversity, there's a lot of them, they have adopted the report wholeheartedly, and they say from now on, our money, our programs, our attention, our sympathy goes to the smallholders. That's what we want to build in the future, and we withdraw the support and the push for the large industrial monocultures, little by little. That is what is happening on the international level. So I'm not the only person that's telling you that there is this fork in the road where we can go big and industrial, or we can go small and safe, right? And it's really going to be up to mostly people of your age to decide what we're going to do. The other good news is the EU. I don't know if any of you are familiar with food laws in the European Union. But a good 10 years, there's somebody nodding her head, a good 10 years before the ISTD report even came, the European Union had gone also for multifunctionality, also for supportive farmers, not so much because they realized the yield was higher per acre, but because they recognized the farmer's cultural contribution to society, and they actually formally recognized farmers as stewards of the land that everyone in the country depends on. And by that, I mean all you have to do, I mean, when I mentioned before about rural depopulation, if you go out to an area that used to have a lot of little towns and people living there and little churches and bridges and stuff like that, and then they all leave, which is what's happening in a lot of parts of Canada, what happens? The churches rot away, the schools are closed, the bridges fall apart, the old graveyards are gone, the orchards cave in, the pastures turn to brush. You do not have a beautiful rural landscape because you don't have anybody there who loves it and is taking care of it. And you can say, well, maybe it'll go back to wildness, but it doesn't. It already does in a way. If there are people taking care of it, there are often people taking care of wetlands for obvious reasons. There are a farmer who wants to have ducks on his property or who understands that he needs that level of in the water table to come up all around me. This is quite common now. There's quite a lot of beaver ponds and forests. And I fortunately live in an area where the farming is mostly multifunctional, always has been, because the soil isn't very fertile. So they've had to mix like apples and dairy, right? And this has kept them the most. That county is the most prosperous farming county in all of Quebec. And it is the major mixed farming. The counties that are, you know, all crops or all hogs or something do not do anywhere near as well. So again, this is something to really, really, really think about. Just checking what time we are. Now, yeah. I have left out one problem that some non-meat eaters, you know, have castigated me with, me, which is the plain, you know, moral problem of killing and eating a sentient being. And I really do understand that. And in fact, as long as we do have mixed farming, we will have animals that are raised to be killed. But they will have a much better life than they would under this current system, where they're kind of out of sight, out of mind. And it's also that whole problem I said before. You have to kill the vegetables to eat too. The cycle of life demands that you kill something to eat. And in the case of the animals, their lives are much longer and much better. I like to tell the story. I buy pork, which I hardly ever eat, but as a treat once in a while. It's quite expensive, from a neighbor who raises it organically. And I stopped there once to get something or other, and she has one of those big farmer kitchens, and it was full of, you know, those big plastic tubs, you know, those big plastic buckets. There must have been like 15 of them, and they were full of something. It didn't smell bad, but it did not look nice, right? And I looked at her, and she was embarrassed, of course, because of the state of her kitchen. She said, well, it was like now. It was in the dead of winter and really, really cold, I think minus 20 or something. And she said, well, it's so cold out today, we thought we would bring their slop. It was the pig, the hog slop. It was all the mixed meat and, not meat, but milk and eggs and old veggies and grain that they fed the pigs with. They brought it in the kitchen to warm it up because it would make the hogs happier to have nice warm food that day. And I thought, that is the way, that's the animal I want to eat. If I'm going to eat an animal, I want to eat an animal who had a life. And by the way, small holdings cannot afford to slaughter animals young. You know, they will keep them as old as possible. I mean, typically people very rarely ate lamb in the old days. They ate mutton because you kept the sheep longer because you could get more money because it would get bigger, you know. This idea, again, of slaughtering things very, very young so they're tender. And you don't have to actually do any real cooking to them. Everyone I know out in the country gets chickens from their local farmers. We all boil and stew the chickens. I mean, we do not roast and fry chickens. They're way too chewy, right? Because they had a life running around in the yard. They consequently need to be braised in wine or something. They're delicious. They have an incredible flavor, but you can't do that. So I do understand not wanting to kill things, and I think the people that don't want to don't have to eat meat, but I think they need, like the Green Party folks with Elizabeth May, I think they really need to understand the whole system and know who's on their side, who's going to make the good vegetable food for them too. Instead of, you know, dividing ourselves off, it really hurts farmers' feelings, by the way. You know, a farmer who raises cows and does his best to make their life good, to hear that, you know, people think he's evil, right? It's the same thing. We have to look at raising good food because it all works in together.